This story will start in the apostolic period. You know, 40 years after the ascension of our master, the city of Jerusalem was laid siege by the Roman armies, and they surrounded Rome, and people were starving to death. It was awful. It was a massacre. It was a holocaust. And there was, at this time, a fear that the teaching would be lost, because all the notable sages were involved in this revolt, and they were shut up in the city, and it looked like the great minds of the Sanhedrin, and the leaders of the Pharisees, the schools of the Pharisees, were all going to die in this siege, and with them, it's like, oh, we didn't write anything down. With them goes the whole teaching, right? So what happened was, one of the leaders of the sages, an old man, 80 years old at the time, by the name of Yochanan ben Zakkai, orchestrated an escape from Jerusalem by faking his death and being carried out of the city in a coffin out to the Roman lines, where he promptly surrendered. You probably know the story. It comes in, you've probably heard the story before. So this is the escape of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Zakkai is easy to remember because Zakkai is the same as Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus is the same as Zakkai. With the Greek endings. Yochanan is John. So this is another way to say it would be John, son of Zacchaeus. Yeah. Yochanan ben Zakkai. Well, Yochanan ben Zakkai asks the Romans for some favors. He says, can you get me these sages? When you finish conquering this city, spare the lives of a couple of these sages. You list some names. And give me and my disciples the city of Yavne, which was a Jewish city closer to the coast that the Romans had already conquered. They give him what he asks for. The reason they give him what he asks for is another story. But they give him what he asks for. So he starts an academy of sages at Yavne. Well, he's an old man. He doesn't live a long time. Actually lives another 40 years. But he doesn't lead the academy very long. Instead, he hands it off to a disciple named Gamaliel, son of Shimon, Ben Shimon. Right. You know this guy, because you know his great-granddad and his great-great-granddad. His great-great-granddad was a rabbi named Hillel. His grandfather was Gamaliel. That was Paul's teacher. Yeah. His father was a man named Shimon. That was Paul's classmate. Paul was, summa cum laude or something in the class. And then this is his son, Gamaliel ben Shimon, or we call him Gamaliel 2. He's not at all like Gamaliel 1. We liked Gamaliel 1. We don't like Gamaliel 2 so much. Gamaliel 2 was not nice to believers. Gamaliel 1 was nice to us. Gamaliel 2, not so nice to us. He's the one who introduced the blessing against heretics and kicked us out and that sort of thing. Anyway, so he's not. We're not big fans of his, but he took over the academy, and he started to rule this. Put together a Sanhedrin there at Yavne, a new Sanhedrin, the Sanhedrin reborn after the destruction of Jerusalem. He puts this together at Yavne, and he's got some of Yochanan ben Zakkai's disciples to work with there. He's got the famous Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. I'm giving you these names because if you start reading Mishnah, you're going to encounter all these names over and over and over. Because the arguments that took place at Yavne is the contents of what's in here. All these arguments between these sages sitting around at Yavne after the destruction of Jerusalem. That's the majority contents of what you have here. And it was Rabbi Gamaliel's idea to centralize the Jewish people in the absence of Jerusalem and the temple. Because up until then, Jerusalem and the temple and the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem and the priesthood, that had been the center of the Jewish people all over the world. You had a center. Sometimes you even had a king. All that's gone. And he realized the Jewish people would perish without a center. without a central authority. And so he worked to create a central authority. He dedicated it, and he had, this is, he's such a hard head. You know, he's like one of these people that's just such a hard head, such a bulldog. He's excommunicating people left and right. He excommunicated Eliezer ben Hyrcanus because he disagreed about how whether an oven could be made kosher again or not if it was dismantled and then put back together. He excommunicated him. This is the way he was with people. And he excommunicated us too. He's a bulldog. But, you know, you got to be a bulldog sometimes. He's trying to save a nation and say, Sadducees, you're out. Believers, you're out. So he's trying to centralize everything. And this is what he did. All right, so that's Yavne, the conversations at Yavne, and the arguments at Yavne, the stories of Yavne, the fights at Yavne constitute a lot of the material here. All right, then there's another Jewish revolt. The academy at Yavne ends. The Sanhedrin has to move up to the Galilee. It moves around from place to place in the Galilee. It's in Tiberias for a while. Then it's by the time we get to the 3rd century, late 2nd century, 3rd century, it moves to some place called Sepphoris. Now, Sepphoris is a nice city. Nice city built by Herod Antipas, right? And it's the nice thing about Sepphoris after the second Jewish revolt, I mean, the really, really nice thing about it is it's still standing. And the reason it's still standing is because it surrendered to Rome right away. In the first revolt and the second revolt, the Romans arrived, they said, we surrender. Both times. So it's a Roman-friendly city. Rabbi Judah the Prince, who is a descendant of Gamaliel and these fellows, he's still in the same family line. Rabbi Judah the Prince is also a Roman-friendly fellow. He gets along famously with the Roman government, and he's very, very wealthy. And if you're very wealthy, you do get along with the Romans, because then you can pay all the bribes and this sort of thing. So he gets along well with the Romans because he bribes them and he pays them off. And this allows him to reestablish the Sanhedrin there in Sepphoris. This is what he does. And while in Sepphoris, now here's the important part. His name is Rabbi Judah the Prince. You'll hear him called Yehuda Hanasi. That means Judah the Prince. While in Sepphoris, Judah the Prince starts to write down, actually to compile, because other sages had already started the process, such as Rabbi Meir or Rabbi Akiva. He starts to compile the oral tradition into a written document. This is blasphemy! It's unheard of! But he was big enough and powerful enough to do it. The reason he did it was because after two crushing Jewish revolts and a deportation and an exile, a forced exile, the traditions were being lost. Judaism was spinning out of control without a temple and a central authority. And he saw that the oral law could no longer remain oral and be preserved. So he said, for future generations, for the sake of future generations, we have to write. And he wrote. He created a textbook. Basically, it's a textbook of interpretations and traditions on the Torah called the Mishnah. And that's what we have. That's the Mishnah. The Mishnah. Okay? The Mishnah is the oral law. The oral law is the Mishnah. The Mishnah is the oral law written down. The Mishnah is the oral law, no longer oral. Okay? All right. What's the value of the Mishnah? Well, if you're a rabbi, it's very valuable. You know, it's like that's like asking a lawyer what's the value of a legal code. You know, but the rest of us don't read law books too much. You know, if you're not a lawyer or if you're not suing someone or whatever involved in some terrible litigation, you're not too interested. And the Mishnah is kind of the same way. It's a very narrow band of interest for most people in the Mishnah. However, it turns out that it's fabulous for establishing the historical context of the New Testament. Even though Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi wrote it down in the year 200, around the year 200 is when he compiled it, nevertheless, he's compiling an oral tradition from several generations earlier, and several generations earlier happens to be the days of the apostles. So, it's fabulous. It's like this amazing gift from God that he's given us to be able to understand the New Testament. I can't even explain to you how blind we would be to understanding the New Testament if we didn't have the Mishnah to compare it to. And, you know, to give us the backdrop. And the same thing with Josephus. You know, how blind we would be without that one historian, Flavius Josephus, who gives us the whole backdrop of the New Testament. It's like Hashem, you know, he saw what the apostles put together, and he said, "This is a nice try, but I think they're going to need more. They're going to need a little bit more." So he gave us Josephus, and he gave us the Mishnah. All right. It gives us the Mishnah is written in Hebrew. It's written in Hebrew that was spoken in those days. It's not Aramaic. Most Jews spoke Aramaic in those days, but it's written in Hebrew. So it gives us rabbinic Hebrew. It gives us a window into understanding the kind of Hebrew that was spoken in the days of the apostles, the days of Yeshua. It's fabulous. What a fabulous gift. So it's very, for New Testament scholarship, it's invaluable. It's so valuable. It's invaluable. Like, we couldn't do without it. Couldn't do without it. All right. But in terms of, like, edification, if you just want to, like, I just really want to hear from the Lord today. No. No, 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 no. That's not what it's for. That's what this is for. That's what the Bible's for. That's not what the Mishnah is for. Make sense? Okay. So, I would say the Mishnah has a limited value, especially for Gentile believers, you know, in terms of personal study. I wouldn't encourage you, unless you're really interested in pursuing, you know, like, I want to get, you know, into the scholarship, I wouldn't encourage you to, like, get too deep into the Mishnah. There's stuff you should read. You should read Pirkei Avot. You know, everybody should read Pirkei Avot. You know, and then it's good to read the stuff on the holidays when the holidays come around. Read Rosh Hashanah at Rosh Hashanah, Yoma at Yom Kippur, Pesachim at Passover, you know, those sorts of things. If you want to read Mishnah, that makes a lot of sense. And you'll even find those right in the holiday maksors. A lot of it is probably not, like, you know, like Tractate Yadayim, unless you're really just dying to know, you know, all the minutiae about ritual hand washing. In the days, you know, in Pharisaic law, it's probably not going to be your thing. All right, so just a few minutes left. I thought, you know, we should read a little bit of Mishnah, just so you get a taste. And I have the Neusner, one volume English. On the second page, what we'll do is I'll let you pick one out. You'll see the order of the Mishnah. You'll see that it's actually divided into six orders. Think of the six orders as like books, okay? There's Zeraim, which means seeds. This is going to have all the laws that have to do with agriculture. Also has all the laws of prayer in there. There's Moed, which is... Oh, I'm sorry. There you go. There's Moed, which is festivals. Okay, like the Moedim. So this will have all the laws regarding the appointed times and the festivals. There's Nashim, that's women. This has all the laws that are especially pertinent to women's issues. Nezikin is damages. This is has a lot of laws about tort law, you know, litigation, suing people, court disputes, damages, punitive damages, that sort of thing. Kodashim is holy things. This relates to ritual purity, laws about ritual purity, and sacrifices. And Toharot is almost completely about ritual purity issues, matters of dealing with Levitical clean and unclean laws and that sort of thing. So then you can see how it breaks down into the different books. I don't have time to read through each of these. I wasn't planning on it anyway because it would just be zone out time. this will be useful for you. I mean, if I cite, you know, you'll see if you read Torah Club or something, you know, you'll see a citation. It might say, like if it says M. Hulin 23 or 2-3. You're like, what the heck is Mchulam? You know? Well, I'm telling you how to read that. M stands for Mishnah. Hulin stands for common things. All right, so you know it's from the book Common Things in the Mishnah, and then the 2-3 would be chapter and verse. Make sense? All right, but you don't have to know that. I mean, it might be useful to you if you wanted to look something up. Like, let's say you wanted to say, what is that? Lancaster is I think he's taking that out of context. And then you look it up. You just say, okay, where's Hulin? And now you're going to have to find tractate Kodeshim, and then you're going to find Hulin, and then you're going to flip open, you're going to find it, you're going to find that I was spot on. I was absolutely right, and you are wrong. All right. Well, maybe not. Okay, so that's how that works. So which one do you want to... I'll read you a little bit. We'll just close tonight. I'm going to read you a little bit of material from the Mishnah, and then we'll be done. Just because I want you to have a flavor for it. So.
Zoharim and Maserat. Maserat. Tithes.
Okay, all right. All right.
Number one.
Under Zoharim.
Yes.
And which tithes? Maserot?
Yes.
Maserot. Okay. All right. Yes. Well, Maser means tenth or ten, right?
Right.
And so Maserot would be tenths or tithes. Yeah. All right. So we'll learn a little bit about tithing tonight.